our meeting for us, please?
Hector's not in attendance, John.
Do you want me to start, John?
Yes, if you would, Gabriel, please.
Kia ora tātou. Kia ora ki te atua, maungurongo ki te whenua, me he whakaro pai ki ngā tangata katoa, e te atua humai ki a mātou, tō mātauranga me tō aroha. Āmeni. Nice and quick.
Thank you. Thank you. Apologies. There's an apology for Jo, who will be in and out a bit because she's travelling to Queenstown. There's an apology from Catherine, who has to pop out for a bit. There's an apology from Andrew Brandt for the same reason. Are there other apologies, Anna?
Yes, I have an apology for early departure from Tania McCall, and also an apology from Mary Johnston, who is unwell, and Jo Domigan will be presenting her people report later on today.
Thank you.
And John.
All right, well, those apologies may be sustained.
Sorry, John. Lestia, I just have to slip out for a short while at 11 o'clock, but I'll be back.
Thank you, Lester.
Chair, I have to apologise.
Anyone else here, Jackie?
Departure. Early departure for right. me, so John.
Thank you. Any others? All right. If there's changes to the conflict of interest register itself, you can let Anna know. Does anybody other than the normal Naitahu and car parking and the city councillors and car parking and anything else that they're involved in, are there any other members who have conflicts that they are aware of for today's meeting? Or does any member think another member has conflicts? Yep.
Yeah, Aaron? Just when it comes to the CFAC DSAC part, Naomi can take over if you need commentary, just around the alcohol submission. I took no part and I'll take no part today. I hold a liquor license and also hold a manager's license.
Okay, thanks for that, Aaron. That's noted. Yeah. Any others? Thank you. The minutes of the 21st of October have been circulated. Are there any corrections? Can I have a motion? Barry, would you move that they be sustained?
Happy to move.
Aaron, would you second?
Sure.
Thank you. I'll put the motion that the minutes of the 21st of October be sustained. All those in favour, just on to make it easier, just raise your right hand so I can see them on the screen. Okay, thank you, Carrie. We go to the action items. There's really only one which comes up in the agenda, so we will come back to that later. It's an item 16 of PX. I'll go to my update, and can I start by extending a very warm welcome to the Honourable Amy Adams, who we've already heard on this. As I'm sure all of you are aware, Amy has been appointed to the Board of Health New Zealand. I want to do, and I know all other board members want to do the same, which is to make the transition to Health New Zealand as smooth as possible, both for our staff and the users of our health system in Canterbury. And it does occur to me that if we think we have a large task doing our best for the patients of Canterbury, spare a thought for the Board of Health New Zealand and Amy, who have to do that, along with the Māori Health Advisory Board for all of New Zealand. I just want to comment on Monday last, the government mandate requiring all those in the health sector to be double vaccinated came into effect. Its purpose to protect as far as possible all New Zealanders from the effects of COVID was obvious. Sadly, some of our staff opted not to be vaccinated, and the CEE in his weekly newsletter has already thanked them for their services to the CDHB. And on behalf of the board, it's sad to see those people leave us, but I would like to thank them for the contribution they made during their time as working for the DHB and also their contribution to the public of Canterbury. Unfortunately, we now have a community case of COVID, which was confirmed in Christchurch yesterday. As our public health officials have reacted swiftly and well, and as we have come to expect from them, But it does, however, highlight the need to remain vigilant and to push to complete the outstanding vaccination and the additional testing work. Particular, we must work very, very hard with our Maori and Pacific providers to ensure we achieve equity. Now, I thank the wider vaccination and testing staff previously for their sterling work, but today I would particularly want to acknowledge the work of our Maori and Pacifica and ethnic group providers for the outstanding work they are doing, along with community efforts, which are helping us to reach the equity target we need. There is one other matter I need to advise you of. Late yesterday afternoon, I received a letter from the Office of the Minister of Health, and the letter is signed by both the Minister of Health and the Minister of Finance, approving our annual plan. Now, for the last 3 years, our annual plan has not been approved, not because of any of the clinical or other content, but simply because of the disquiet with our financial performance and its unsustainability. So I think this approval is a mark from the ministers that this organisation is moving in the right direction. We already know the figures, we've talked about them. I want to pay particular tribute publicly in the approval of this plan to the CEO and to the senior management staff, but also everybody within the organisation and all of the board members who have undertaken a difficult task and reached a conclusion, which I think is very important for the Canterbury District Health Board to have that ministerial approval for the plan. We can come and discuss that a little later if we want to, but I think it is a mark of a turnaround in the financial sphere, and that has, as I say, not just been the board, not just the senior management, but everybody in the organisation has made a contribution, and I pay particular tribute in that to Dan Coward and our Changing Our Futures program. It's not just Dan, there's been a lot of people involved in that. But it's also a whole lot of areas right across the organisation that have led to the savings we have made, the savings that are expected in the new plan. And I think we can be pleased with that outcome after a three-year hiatus. And in that, thanks, I would mention the Crown Monitor, who has been a very significant supporter for myself and for the CE through this process. So having said that, I'll now go straight to you, Peter.
Kia ora koutou, everyone. Lovely to welcome you to Amy to this forum. So, so a few things to highlight for you all. Firstly, just apologies. My team will be in and out a bit today. They're just dealing with a number of pressing matters around supporting the COVID response. So they will be in and out this morning. I particularly also want to welcome, is she on the screen? Let me quickly check, is Norma with us? Yeah, Norma is with us, Norma Campbell. So one of the things I'm really pleased to confirm last week was the appointment of Norma to the executive lead for maternity and midwifery services, joining the office of the clinical executive alongside Helen Skinner as the chief medical officer, Becky Hickmott as the executive director of nursing, and Jackie, who's on screen, as the executive lead for allied health. So we're really trying to strengthen the leadership that sits in our clinical space, the partnership between clinical leadership and management leadership, and wonderful to have Norma's leadership across that maternity and midwifery space, supporting both Canterbury and the West Coast. So So let me highlight a quick few things by way of overview, and then can take questions from the from my report. I think I've mentioned at QFA three priorities as an executive we're focused to. One is obviously making sure we support our community around the COVID response and all of its elements. But part of that is responding to COVID in a way that we can continue to deliver the appropriate care that our community needs in all of the other spheres of healthcare that the health system provides, from access to GPs to mental health supports through to cancer care in a hospital setting. So one of the successes of these next months is not only providing safe care as COVID as it will arrive into our community and spread, but it's also about keeping care going in the other elements to make sure our community is well supported. So that's the first priority. Second priority is obviously over the next months is making sure the organisation is supported and prepared in the transition to Health New Zealand. Increasingly, that will become demanding as particularly operational frameworks become clearer. And then the third priority, which John has alluded to, and it's nice to have an annual plan that's signed, but one of the things is about delivering or moving us towards that financially sustainable health system that actually allows us to start Health New Zealand in good shape, the opportunity to keep obviously finding savings, but continue to invest in the right places in our health system. Right, so let me just quickly touch on COVID. You'll be aware we have one community case that is a returnee from Auckland, a Māori 36-year-old woman who actually has been vaccinated, but she is COVID positive, a family of six. So we are supporting them in terms of both their health and welfare, and making sure obviously public health are doing their amazing mahi in terms of following through on all of the various close contacts and places of interaction. The person concerned did all the right things in terms of once they were concerned, they isolated themselves, they got themselves tested and continued to isolate until the results came through. But there is vulnerability given there's a family of six children and potentially other members of that family may be infected. We'll find out, no doubt, over the next few days. So, but public health's doing a fantastic job there. And our COVID readiness group in terms of community response is obviously making sure all of the actions are being taken, from obviously standing up additional testing capacity, as well as all the contact tracing and so forth. In terms of preparedness, the hospital actually is in pretty good shape, ready for COVID. Remember, our best protection and preparation there is to get our community vaccinated. I'll come to that shortly, but the facilities team have just handed over the refitted what we call Parkside Ground Medical, which effectively will provide us a ward for the care of medical patients, but we'll have that as a dedicated COVID ward to help stream and protect the wider hospital in terms of where COVID infected patients will be supported in terms of their acute illness. So that's in place, which is fantastic. We're resourcing up ICU beds. We've got additional ventilators ready to deploy should we need those. But actually all of the modelling says, particularly now that we're fast approaching that 90% double vaccinated, actually our hospital system should be able to cope in support of the care of people, especially if COVID spreads in a relatively controlled way through our community. and hopefully the traffic light system, vaccine certificates, and all of those other measures will help support that restrained progress, if you like, of the virus through the community. So the main focus at the moment from the I don't think Helen's on the call at the moment. Helen is the SRO in the COVID response. The main response is really on making sure we're working with our community providers, Māori Health Pacifica provided included, to make sure we're setting up in terms of being able to support people who do become infected to basically self-isolate and be kept supported from a health perspective in their homes. And we will partner with other agencies around supporting the welfare elements of families that have been asked to isolate. So that is where all of the focus and attention is going at the moment, to make sure as a system we can respond and we've got capacity and people are being set up to provide the appropriate care. So we'll come back to that one, I'm sure. So community care, very much the focus. Hospital preparedness, we're in pretty good shape. In terms of vaccination, we continue to plow on. I think we've clocked over, where did the number this morning? 827,000 doses of vaccine have now been delivered across the Canterbury community. So we're sitting at just on 94% first dose across the whole population, 82% fully vaccinated. So that's just a fabulous effort. So for Māori, there is still concern there. We're sitting at 82% first dose for Māori, but that is catching up fast. And obviously, the delay then, the three-week delay, sees only 64% fully vaccinated. So that's, again, the gift of time, hopefully, we've got till COVID starts to become present in our community. The next 3 weeks are just critical to make sure we get ourselves to that 90% target at a minimum. So we're anticipating on the modelling that Māori vaccination will hit 90% by the first week of December, first dose. By Christmas, then hopefully we'll have that 90% double vaccinated. We should hit overall for our population 90% double vaccinated by the first week of December. So there's some really good news, amazing work, you know, 100 plus clinic settings, plus about 100 plus mobile settings, lots of targeting to those areas where there's hesitancy or where there are pockets in our community where we're still lagging in terms of coverage. At a territorial authority, I think the areas that are overall that are lagging is the Hurunuri district at 88% and the Kaikoura district at 85% first dose. So lots of effort and initiatives are going in to support those communities overall.
John, excuse me, sorry to interrupt, but can I just ask a question before Peter leaves?
We'll come to questions at the end of Peter's report, Gabriel.
I'm almost through. So obviously, vaccination, key component. AstraZeneca will be available from the end of November as an alternate for the few people that will need an alternate. Boosters will also be available from the end of November for those who have crossed over that 6 month age group. So there's lots of work still to do in this space. We've modeled out that pretty much through to the end of July next year, we'll need to keep delivering about 25,000 vaccinations a week, anticipating boosters and anticipating that there'll be the addition of the 5 to 11 age group that will come into play in the new year sometime. We've obviously, as every other, many other organisations have had to enact the health order. The numbers, thankfully, have come down significantly, but nevertheless, we are feeling the loss of a number of our staff. So we've seen to date 80 terminations, and there's a further 79 stood down while we continue to work through the process with those people. Hopefully some of them will still choose to get themselves vaccinated. And we have a number of others, 40 odd, who are seeking a medical exemption. The practical reality with the medical exemption is that the criteria is really tight. And so it's unlikely many, if not all, will not qualify, but we're awaiting the decision on those 40 who sought a medical exemption. Various teams are feeling the loss of people, but generally we've been able to mitigate the departure of some of our staff. Norma's done a fabulous job in supporting particularly our maternity and midwifery services. So that applies particularly to the West Coast, which maybe is not of as much interest to this board, but the loss, for instance, of midwifery services in Buller has needed to be covered. And they've done a great job as a team to make sure the women who are expecting a baby are being supported appropriately. There are pockets of vulnerability, particularly in our mental health nursing and certainly in a couple of other services, but we're working hard to make sure we can continue to deliver safe care. So I'll just quickly mention a few other key things that are happening in the system. I won't labour the conversation. So the provision or the regulation around water has now moved from the public health team on at the start of this week to the new agency, Te Mata Arawai, so that the whole regulation, health protection elements of maintaining safe drinkable water and making sure that is now being picked up under a new agency. Obviously, our public health team will continue to interface with that agency should any issues arise. End of Life Care Act came into force on November 7th, so that option is now available to people, and that process has been very much led and run by the Ministry of Health. You'll have seen the passing of the bill around fluoridation, which will have impact, obviously, with the decision-making moving to the Director General of Health, so around the fluoridation of water supply, so potentially that will have impact for us into the future. John's highlighted that we have a signed annual plan, so we celebrate that and now get on or continue to try and deliver all of the expectations associated with that. And I want to say perhaps the most significant to last, and we can have a conversation about this, and that is the signing of a partnership agreement between the Runanga of Ngāi Tahu across our Rohi, the signing of the partnership agreement with each of the Runanga with CDHB, really establishing that partnership relationship where moving forward, we will actively co-design, actively prioritize, and actively co-invest in the delivery of health services for the people of this community. It's a fantastic prelude to the direction of travel under Health New Zealand and the establishment of the Māori Health Authority at a local level with iwi relationship boards or partnership groups. CDHB under Health New Zealand, I think, will be well positioned to hopefully model that partnership approach to improving equity in health outcomes for our population. So really appreciative, particularly of Gabriel and Fiona's support and leadership and Barry's leadership in that space. So thank you.
Okay, thank you. Now, I've had a message from Gabriel and she has a question on the COVID case. If anybody else wants to ask a question, can they just use the reaction button at the bottom of the screen and raise their hand on the screen? Gabriel.
Excuse me, John, just before Gabriel speaks, Andrew Dickerson has given his apologies. He's had a severe power cut and is not able to stay connected.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, John, and thank you, Peter, for that. It was really great to see that partnership agreement signed. It's the culmination of a lot of talking, so it's good to see some action. My question to you around the COVID case is that are you aware the woman with the six kids family's at the school, and so they've mobilised, Fiti Ora have mobilised with mihi to really swarm in and drop down into that community and get right into it to try and get as many people as possible tested and as many people as possible vaccinated.
Yeah. I was talking to Tanya earlier, Gabriel. So I've been interacting with her this morning, and Hector and Helen and Becky, right, I think, have been following through with her to try and support the various actions that she's initiated to make sure we're doing that in a joined up fashion. Hector, did you have any comment?
You're right, Gabe. Yesterday, the principal was very supportive, and the vaccination teams are looking to work with that community today. The whānau wanted to go into MIQ yesterday. Initially, it was they were going to stay at home, but they wanted to go into MIQ, and I just got an update this morning from MIQ. They're as comfortable as they can be, and I guess I can say in this forum that the child that accompanied the mum north has also been confirmed as positive. The remainder haven't come back yet. And if I'm wrong, Tani, you can just let me know. That's as we know so far. And they are connected to Piki Te Ora, a primary care practice, and a few other health issues have popped up. So that's useful. We're wrapping around whānau order services because there are some challenges with the whānau, but so far, so good. But you're right about Te Waka Unua. It's quite a big community, and the support of the school has been really great in order to connect with the health services so far, and we'll keep a close eye on them.
Oh, that's great. So, sorry, the Tanya I was talking about was Fiti Ora, Tanya.
I knew that, but I was, if I had any information wrong around the testing stuff, Tanya McCall was the one I was looking for, yes. A nod. So I appreciate there were two Tanyas. Yes, thank you.
Okay. That's exactly fantastic.
Thank you. Now, let me run along the Barry.
Got me, John.
Kia ora. Peter, just a question on your report. So as at the end of September, we were 20% behind on our planned care discharges, and the report clearly outlines the reasons for that. What are the initiatives that we're undertaking to catch that up? Because we have quite a challenging target to achieve for the year.
Yeah, so the team, despite lockdowns, I think is doing really well in terms of trying to maintain and support planned care delivery, though, as you say, we are behind. We were complimented on how well we were doing as a health system comparatively with the rest of the country the other day by the Ministry of Health. So I think there are some pretty sobering impacts nationally around planned care delivery. We're partly waiting for, we're obviously trying to maximise particularly first specialist assessments and then obviously all of the planned care work that needs to be done. We've actually put in a new perioperative service manager across our theatre world to try and join up Christchurch campus and Burwood to make sure we've got some coordinated leadership across that space. We're establishing a new ops and new theatre governance groups, and the analytics team, I've forgotten their names. What's John Wilkinson's team called, Tracy?
Decision support
are doing a fantastic job of shaping up some much much more detailed reports at a specialty level, so each specialty can clearly see where they've fallen behind in terms of numbers to deliver our health target for the year. And so we're actively planning and prioritising those procedures. So there's some good work going on. This is kind of illustrative of, as we live with the emergence of COVID, trying to maintain as much of, as possible in the midst of that, planned care is going to be one of the ongoing challenges for us. But that's hopefully what we'll succeed in doing, which unfortunately is not the experience of many countries internationally, where they've literally just been so overwhelmed that everything pretty much has had to stop.
Peter, last year when we came out of COVID.
Yeah, the last comment is we are waiting for a bit of direction and leadership out of the Ministry of Health, because we would expect that they would provide some additional resource to help in that catch-up piece. But at this stage, we haven't had any direction. We are meeting with them. They're actually visiting, still planned at the end of next week. So hopefully that might give some clarity. Tracy, you might have some insights on that.
Oh, I was just going to add, I think the other thing, the important thing to note is the COVID planning in terms of, and Helen might want to comment, in terms of how we're organising our capacity, tries to protect planned care resource through obviously the creation of the COVID ward in the old AML site, but also in terms of how we intend to use Burwood. So I think whilst there's obviously been, and there will be some challenges, I think the way that plan has been put together is to try to protect as much planned care capacity going forward. Helen, I don't know if you wanted to say
something. Yeah, apologies for lateness. I'm just dealing with a COVID problem. So absolutely, and really around that is managing as much as we can within the community, obviously in a safe way, because the most important thing is that we keep patients safe, but obviously in the community where they live. And so that's the reason why we're at speed working on the coordination or community hub, so that we're able to do that, so that we're able to continue, as you say, as much planned care, obviously within the escalation, the hospital escalation framework that's shortly due to be changed. And we did maintain that in the last time in terms of community cases a few weeks ago in terms of high levels of planned care.
Thank you, John.
Thank you. Jamie?
Thank you. Thanks, Peter, for that update. And thank you, John, for yours too. There's a lot of really positive things happening. Just with respect to the vaccination rollout, you know, we're at the pointy end of the program now, and I'm not sure if this modelling is linear, but are we anticipating those lagging with vaccination numbers to be significantly more difficult to reach than perhaps those in the earlier stage? And is there a strategy around converting them or reaching these people or not, or is it largely going to remain the same?
So we have way more capacity than we have demand, and that tipped probably almost a month ago. And so I think there are about 64,000 people still across the Canterbury region who have not had a vaccine or are not booked for one. So that's still a significant number in our population, and unfortunately still overrepresented by Māori. So 8,500 of that 64 are Māori who have not yet had a vaccine or booked. So pretty much for the last 2-3 weeks, the focus has very much gone, and the strategy has changed to much more reliance on mobile and pop-up and actually going to all of those not really hot spots, but going to those spots within our community where there is significant lag in terms of vaccination rates. And so very targeted campaigns, working closely with partners, closely with community settings and leaders in those settings to try and help those that are hesitant or have been given misinformation or actually are just wrestling with access, making sure we're actually being right amongst those settings in our community. So yes, very different approach now. It is almost chasing them down family by family, one by one, and certainly.
So obviously, thank you for that. And just a quick follow up on it. Obviously, those 65 or circa 65,000 odd, you know, that gives me confidence that, you know, there is a different approach which will hopefully try and get a lot of those, or certainly a significant portion of those vaccinated. The now above 90% that have at least had one jab, you know, we know, for lack of a better expression, we know they're good for it. I guess what's the strategy around ensuring that these people that have had their first jab hurry up and get their second one now, because we know that there's not any sort of moral...
Well, Jamie, there's got to be a three-week gap for the start, but the second point around that is that figures to date indicate that around 95-96% of those who get the first jab turn up for their second appointment and don't need to be chased. Just to add to what Peter has said, it's very much a case of taking the vaccine to these last pockets of equity. There's mobile clinics. There's been some vaccinations done, I think, on the banks of the Ashley at white baiting stands and things like that. So it is a very, very active campaign.
With the 65,000.
Maybe, Peter, that we could discuss this afternoon with the COVID oversight group, getting some of those schemes that they've already put into place, we could get the information sent to the board, which would answer the queries you've got now.
It'd be very easy to do that, John. Yeah.
Yeah, so we will organise that. Aaron?
Yeah, Peter, so just a couple of quick questions. One is, you said there's 40-odd people going for an exemption of staff, or former staff now, technically, that D-Day's hit. There was the lady that was in the media 2 days ago who said she'd been turned down for her exemption. That was the one around the blood clotting. So how do cases like that go? And if, say, she got the jab and she did clot and she did die, where would it lie then for her family?
It's an interesting hypothetical. I might get Helen to comment, but the reality is, so people need to apply for a medical exemption. The decision making for that actually sits nationally, and there are clear criteria that are designed to make sure people are kept safe through a vaccination process. And there are very few indications as to why a vaccine won't be safe. And people are certainly, as everyone is who gets a vaccine, monitored and supported around their safety with that. So I think all of the evidence to date will suggest that very few people who seek a medical exemption will have a valid reason to do so. But Helen, do you have any further comments? Because you might be closer to this medically than I am.
Yeah, absolutely, Peter. Very, very small numbers. Those where there has been any concern, for example, with previous allergy, for example, have had vaccinations done within the hospital, and that's been managed. So all of those that can get vaccinated, if they're sort of potentially higher risk, that we've been offering that as well in terms of that support. In addition, we provided a clinic up until 11 p.m. On that Monday as well, so that people could get vaccinated at place of work during their shift. And in terms of, the exemptions, that's by a medical practitioner and then has to go centrally. So it's very, very tight in terms of any medical exemption. I can't really comment on the sort of legal side of things in terms of if there is a side effect where we would stand.
And just to be clarified,
from our perspective, Aaron, the point is that it's a Ministry of Health decision centrally. It's not a DHB decision whether or not an exemption should be approved.
And just to be clear too, those that are stood down are still our employees. They just can't work in our healthcare setting. So until those matters get resolved, they remain our employee, but unfortunately can't work, distinct from those for whom we have already terminated their employment.
So that brings me to my follow-up question, or my second question, Peter, is it'll be great to be part of the health board that loses no staff through this. Have we put together a specialist group that is contacting these people who are choosing to opt out of the vaccination, contacting them individually and having rational conversations with them. And I do note that certain departments are more represented than others when it comes to choosing.
Aaron, I think it's covered by item 15 and public excluded, which okay. coming to later.
Yeah, but just to reassure you that our team has been seeking to deal with compassion and kindness. They have met with everyone who's indicated that they're not getting vaccinated personally. They've had a number of those conversations. And I just want to commend you all to kind of an amazing video that Hector and Becky, Norma and Alan Pithy, our infectious disease specialist, did for our staff to help talk them through and think through and reflect on all of the questions that various staff are asking around the vaccination. And I think they handled that beautifully in terms of trying to support people through their hesitancy to get vaccinated.
Cool.
Ingrid.
Thanks, John. Two questions, one of which was the overtime cost associated with the specialist mental health services. I noted in the report that there was about 25 to 40 roster gaps on a daily basis, and I was just wanting to know what the actual fiscal impact of that was. And then the second question was in relation to the booster shots. Is in terms of 6 months, people needing a booster after they've had their vaccine, first vaccine for 6 months, is that being rolled out by the ministry on a text basis? Like, how are we contacting our population to get them back rolled in, you know, in terms of that process?
Yeah, so let me just, and Helen also can comment on the boosters. The reality is I don't believe we yet have the Ministry of Health advice on the protocols that will follow. The reality is we do know who has had a vaccination and when they will be due for their booster, but we'll wait. The early indications are that actually once someone has crossed that 6 month window, then they can basically book themselves in to a vaccination spot to get their booster. But we know who they are. It's a bit like those who've had their first dose who are yet to do their second dose. We know who they are, so we will actively look to make sure we get people across the line for both their second and then at the right time frame their booster. Helen, anything to add there?
No, nothing to add.
Okay, thank you. Now, in terms of overtime for mental health, so we have significant number of vacancies, particularly in our nursing workforce across our health system, and I'm not talking just about hospitals, aged residential care, primary care settings, but CDHB alone, I think Becky has in excess of 100 nursing vacancies. Unfortunately, that is significantly represented in the mental health services. That's putting phenomenal stresses and strains on that team who just do amazing work with some of our most complex patients. So we're doing all we can to support that team. It's really tough when there are significant gaps in rosters and people are very generously putting their hands up to do extra shifts and longer shifts and overtime and so forth. The reality is overtime is expensive, but the reality is the financial cost of that is offset by the vacancy. So it's not really an issue. What's more of a concern is the staff well-being, actually, just the sheer strain that puts on our team trying to deliver safe care. Becky, anything to add there? Because you're across our nursing teams.
Yeah, I think what we're trying to do where possible is to release other staff and backfill into other areas. These are the place where the challenges are or where our most complex cases are. And I think that's what's so difficult as well from a recruitment angle. And it's not our DHB alone. As Peter's indicated, every DHB has got quite considerable challenges within the vacancies and the area of mental health. And it's also an international issue, as I've raised with you all before. We have a dedicated recruitment person who is in there. Mary's team has been amazing working so hard to try to shore that up. We do have some new graduates starting in there for the nursing injury to specialist practice program. And I also want to say that Jackie's team from an allied health perspective are working incredibly well and in partnership with the nursing team to provide a number of supports as well and working as a IDT team in this space. But it remains an area that we're constantly focused on and working with the teams on. So it is a very tough environment indeed.
Thanks.
Did you have two questions, Ingrid?
That was the two, John. That was the
right,
cost
thank of you.
And the booster shot.
Yep, thank you. Lester?
Oh, thanks, John. I just wanted to just take the opportunity to reaffirm what Peter was saying about, given we are in very challenging circumstances, the actual planned care performance on a relative basis is actually very good. You know, SB5 is looking a bit wonky, but, you know, in the circumstances, things are looking pretty good. A couple of evenings ago, Peter and I looked at a deep dive that has been done on wide number of Canterbury's performance parameters. And not only in the planned services, but there's really positive signs right across the board. So interesting scenario, which didn't seem possible. Finances are improving, deficit is reducing, performance across the board is improving. We've asked, it's Peter and I have asked if there could be more comparative information for us, both just within the South Island and across the country. So hopefully, you know, before, at the next board meeting, hopefully we'd be able to report back on that. But overall, some really very positive signs there. Very pleased and congratulations on getting the plan across the line. Pleased to have that off my back. And I was very pleased that I could support it on this occasion. As always, as you expect the messages from me, please do not declare victory too soon. There's a lot of work to do, but very positive signs. And I think the most important thing of the plan being accepted and signed by the two ministers is the sense of confidence in what's happening at Canterbury DHB. So well done to all.
Thanks, Lester. Naomi?
Yeah, mine's kind of a follow-up from Ingrid's question around specialist mental health and just the vulnerability there. I was just wondering, is there any model of care changes? I mean, we've seen increasing demand and issues with staff, and is there any models of care changes that potentially we could work on, or I don't know, funding? Is there something that could help in that space, or is it is staff the kind of the track we're going down at the moment, or do we need to kind of branch out and look at other areas? I see we fund the annual plan looks like there's about a 10% increase in mental health spend overall. Has specialist mental health seen that same increase, or do we need to juggle the way things are going, or in terms of where that spend is for mental health, or what's the kind of, what things are you working on to help that?
Thank you, Naomi. So we've made some deliberate investments in some specific areas where there is
specific areas.
No, someone not on mute, perhaps that's causing the challenge. I'll keep going. So we have made some deliberate investments, for instance, in the mothers and babies area, the eating disorder space, child and adolescent mental health area, child and adolescent family mental health area. So, and actually most of those investments have not been so much into the specialist piece of the mental health service, but actually in the liaison roles back into primary community care responses. So actually trying to make sure we get earlier supports, earlier intervention in some of those really pressured areas in the mental health service. To be honest, the model of care focus, which is true across all of health, applies to mental health, and that is we just need to get better in terms of those earlier interventions, those community supports, working with community providers. And so Tracy with her team, and she might want to comment, are very much trying to, and this is mimicked in the COVID response as well, very much trying to make sure you're resourcing those community providers to be able to keep people well, intervene early, support people in their home settings rather than deteriorating or escalating to a specialist area. But the big gap, unfortunately, this is compounded by the big gap, which we've talked about in terms of our workforce, just the lack particularly of nursing resource in some key areas. Tracy, do you want to make any comment in terms of community resourcing or interventions?
Thanks, Peter, for the opportunity. The only thing I would add is that with funding from the Ministry of Health in partnership with partners across Canterbury and West Coast, we've commenced co-design a model of care review on mental health and addiction services. And I think the first or second workshop was yesterday. I think the board, either CFAC or the board, would probably it's time to brief you on some of the early the process and some of the early findings from that. I think you'll find that very valuable. I mean, having said all of that, your question about workforce for specialist mental health services, unfortunately, we will always have members of our community that require specialist mental health services, and we do need to make sure that we are providing a service in that area that meets their needs. And we do need to be able to recruit from an international market, as Becky has described. So the primary focus is obviously early prevention, a strong whanau-centric support in our community with our primary care, Māori and Pacifica partners. But when they do need access to specialist mental health services, there is obviously a clear expectation that they receive high quality care. And at the moment, with our workforce challenges, the team are doing a phenomenal job to deliver the care that they have. But I think we are, as Becky said, we are recruiting from an international market increasingly. And so any opportunity that we have from a New Zealand Inc. perspective in terms of a health system to engage in international partners for recruitment, I think would be very welcome.
Just briefly to add to that, so John, I think there is, and to reassure you, Naomi, there is some work going on around models of care around the wellbeing model, and some exploration about developing the roles of our Kaiāwhina workforce in this space to support both allied and nursing. So there is some work, it's just it's not fully rolled out yet.
Thanks. I'd love to see that. Be quite keen to see that plan of what you're talking about, Tracy, of the early work that's been done. That'd be fabulous. Thank you.
Okay.
Unmute myself. No one else has hands up. Joe, I know your difficulties, and I'm not sure quite exactly where you are, but we've come to the end of Peter's report. And if you did have a question and you can make it, just go ahead now.
I'll come in now. Thank you, John. And it's a bit. It's working. I just wanted to reiterate just a couple of things, the positive, and then a couple of questions I've got. I agree with you, Sir John. Fiona Pym and Adams are two very strong wahi.
I'm sorry, you're coming and going, Joe. We didn't get any of that.
Okay, well, I think I'll leave it because my phone is patchy. I'll
all right, well, if you get to a spot with a stronger signal, let us know and we can interpose your questions then, Joe.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. All right, we'll go on to item 6. And David, you're seeking approval for the delegations authority, which has already been to QFARC and approved by them. The paper's been circulated and read, if you'd like to speak to that, David.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's correct. Last year, we reviewed these delegations, including some benchmarking against other DHBs. As a result of that, we actually reduced the Chief Executive delegation for CAPEX from 1 million down to 500,000. We've had another review this year. We're not suggesting to change anything other than requesting a change to the delegation for capital expenditure from trust funds, which has been at a level of 50,000 for many years. We're not asking to bring it up to the 500,000, but we are bringing it up to asking to bring it up to 100,000, which will make it a bit more manageable for us, because there's been a push on some of those, and there's a number of those requests coming through at the moment. So I'll take any questions.
All right, is there any questions? If you just press the reaction, raise your hands. Otherwise, as Chair, Barry, will you move in terms of recommendations 1, 2, and 4?
Yes, I will, John. I'll just make a quick comment. I think we bringing the capital delegation down to 500 means we're getting really good visibility on those projects, and I think it was worthwhile to continue with that. Other than that, happy to support the resolutions.
Do I have a seconder?
I'll second to John.
Thanks, Fiona. Is there any discussion? All right, I'll put a resolution in terms of the approval sought at 1, 2, and 4 of the paper. All those in favour, just raise their right hands. Thank you, that is carried. And David, we'll go to item 7, your finance report.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the finance report. We're reporting on the September month end, as we've discussed in detail. So I'll largely take the paper as read, just noting that the tables and graphs both include COVID and Holidays Act. And noting that the ministry had requested us not to budget for vaccination revenues and costs. So that actually is explaining a large part of the variances that you may see in the income statement. So largely our result year to date, if we did exclude COVID and BAU, would be around about 1.6 million unfavourable. And that is largely as a result of our cost for the Chathams being greater than our funding received, and also still the RSV costs that we incurred earlier in the financial year. So I'll take any questions.
Thank you. People with questions, if they press the reaction button and raise their yellow hands. Lester, you were first off the mark.
No, it's not so much a question, but I thought just with the plan being approved, it would be worth asking David just to remind board members that this isn't just a symbolic and a good thing. It's actually got financial implications. Not having your plan approved is not a good thing for many reasons. Would that be possible, David, just to remind the board what it does for the financial side?
So if I could just comment on that, absolutely. It's more than just symbolic. One of the things that the big major points is that our ability to draw down an overdraft facility, which is managed for New Zealand Health Partnerships, but that is linked to our latest signed financial plan. Now, not having had one for 3 years, we've been limited for the maximum that we can actually overdraft that we can go into. Not that we want to go to the limits on those, but it does give us some element of comfort. And so that overdraft limit will now increase.
Thank you. Naomi?
You just mentioned about the Chathams. I saw in QFAC notes that it looked like that was kind of all the ministry had kind of given us a position that they weren't going to fund us any further for that. And that was kind of the final landing of it. Is that correct? Is there any kind of back and forth for that still, or are we just going to accept what the funding we're getting for the Chathams now is it?
Absolutely. My understanding is the ministry are saying that there is no extra funding coming along. That is not our viewpoint on that, but there has been no further to-ing and fro-ing on that.
I thought the outcome, David, was that there was going to be a closer look at the rural adjuster and the population-based funding model, but I could be wrong. Do you want to comment on that?
Thank you for the comment.
Shall I make a comment? Yeah. Thank you. So, you know, the ministry has been very clear they're not prepared to fund us anymore for the Chathams. They have said, you're correct, they have said that's included in the rural adjuster. We have had a look at the rural adjuster, and yes, the amendment was made for the Chathams back in 2015 or 16, when there was some technical changes to how the population-based funding formula was compiled. Since then, it's become a little bit more difficult to trace the funding year to year, as you can imagine, with the combination of demographic increase, technical changes, and the way that the funding envelope is compiled. Trying to track each of those changes through is a little bit problematic. I think it would be fair to say we could spend quite a bit of time doing the technical analysis, and my instinct would be the response will be we will look at the rural adjuster as part of the move to Health NZ. But I think I'd probably appreciate some direction from maybe through Peter or the board about how much you want us to pursue this, maybe through QFAC, Barry. But yeah, happy to take direction on it. We are doing some work, but
I'm happy to pick it up,
Barry, because I think there is some work we need to do around the rural adjuster as part of transition.
I'm happy to pick that up, John. My question, Doug, can you just make a quick comment on when the next equity call is coming from the ministry for the year? And secondly, just a quick update on where we're at with the annual audit, please.
Absolutely. So the equity, I'm not expecting that we need to draw down anything for some months. We do have some dynamics that are floating around with some MECA settlements and others on cash flow, but I don't think at this point in time that I need to be requesting any funds from the ministry. But I have had some dialogue with my counterpart there to make sure that they're aware of the risks that we have there. When it comes down to the annual audit is still progressing. At this point in time, the auditors are largely done their work, and I'm not aware of any known issues. However, they are still waiting for some data, which and performance data, which I believe they're waiting from the ministry from, and they have indicated that there will be no sign-off prior to the end of November, and I think that applies to all DHBs. So we're expecting some movement probably in early December. So I should be able to give QFARC a better update of that on the 30th.
Thank you. Thanks, John.
Thanks. Andrew Brand.
Sure. Hi, David. Just on the personnel costs, on those trends, is it possible to actually see it without the COVID-related FTE?
We certainly can give some of that. Maybe I can give that information at the next QFARC meeting. We had moved away from having the reports excluding Holidays Act and COVID.
Right.
So we can actually provide some of that further information as on an ad hoc basis next time.
Yeah, just trying to see the underlying FTE. And then the one on the IDF, external provider costs, it says excluding COVID-19, but then the variance is described because of COVID-19. Have I got that right?
We actually may have that title. I will need to double check on that one if I can, Andrew.
David, I think the title's from the previous report.
Right.
I'm pretty confident those numbers include COVID.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
We can just double check that, David. Any other questions? All right, well, we're asked to note this report. I'll move that we so note. Do I have a seconder? Thank you, Barry. Is there any further discussion? All those in favour of noting the report, please raise your right hands. Thank you. That is carried. Aaron, we come to the issue of that you mentioned before. So you'll take us through it all, but the alcohol policy bit, and Naomi will speak to that. Is that correct?
Yes, correct.
Okay,
Excuse me, Sir John, if I can just interrupt. Yep. Aaron will speak to the CFAC and DSAC public minutes, and then Naomi will speak to the CFAC, DSAC public excluded minutes in the public excluded
section. Okay, thank you. All right.
Thank you.
Well, we can deal with this bit now then, Aaron.
Well, it was an odd meeting, obviously. Being on Zoom, not that Zoom's rare these days, but certainly for that particular committee, meeting in person seems a lot better. But we did stick to time, which was a first. So there you go. If anyone's got any questions, feel free to fire away.
All right, questions of Aaron? Aaron, will you move the acceptance of those minutes?
Yeah, happy to do so.
Naomi, will you second?
Second.
Thank you. Any discussion? All those in favour, raise their right hands. Thank you. Carried. We will go to item 9, and I will move from the chair the resolution to exclude the public. Is there a seconder? Thank you, Jamie. Is there any discussion? All those in favour of the resolution, please raise your right hands. The hands are getting tired. Thank you. That is carried, and we will go into public.